ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Welcome to another jam-packed episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick journalist Nonkululeko Njilo. Here's what's coming your way. Devastating storms in the Western Cape have us worried about what the future holds. A nation left vulnerable. We look at the dire state of our military.
To be quite honest, it's been long coming. There has been reports, I think, that date back as far as a decade ago. I think they have really gone ignored.
Then how one man is saving lives, one box of medication at a time. And the so-called hardest geezer does the unimaginable. But first, it's been a busy week for the IEC, as not one but two major court judgments had everyone buzzing.
Nonkululeko, it's always lovely having you on the show. Welcome back. How have you been?
I have been great. And how have you been?
I've been very well, thank you. Just not quite ready for winter, but it seems it's here and it's here to stay.
And it's quite scary because I don't think anyone was prepared for this so early. So yeah, it's quite scary.
Definitely. And we'll touch a bit on weather-related issues a bit later in the show. But let's get into our very first story. Now, last week was a pretty big week on the elections front with two major cases making headlines. The first one, of course, it's the one that everyone is talking about, is former president and MK Party main man Jacob Zuma's electoral court victory. Last month, the IEC barred him from running in the upcoming May elections, but he then appealed that. And now he's at the very top of the MK Party's list for parliament, which naturally then paves the way for him to return to public office. What is your take on Zuma's victory and Zuma maybe returning to politics?
Look, I think it was very unprecedented. I think it's the first time in, you know, post-apartheid South Africa that something of this nature is happening. I think a lot of us were taken by surprise. I'm not going to lie. A lot of us assumed that he didn't stand a chance. But like you correctly said, he was at the top of the list. And the electoral court did find that, in fact, the IEC had erred in its decision to bar him from contesting in the first place. So, yes, where we are now is that Zuma is legally permitted to be in parliament should he wish to do so. But I mean, of course, the court didn't give reasons because they had to turn around, you know, the judgment in just 24 hours because the IEC has to finalize the timetable. So that's where we are at the moment.
And of course, the IEC on Friday said that they're now taking the matter to the Constitutional Court. So the battle is certainly far from over. But I also want to touch on the markets and how they've reacted to the ongoing political movements in South Africa. Obviously, it's reacted to Zuma's growing popularity. We saw the rand slump 0.9% against the dollar on Wednesday. And this followed an opinion poll, which, despite its objectivity being questioned by some, it was clearly enough for global markets to do a double take. There's obviously no denying that the MK Party, mostly thanks to Zuma, has certainly made its presence known in the short few months that it's been part of the political game. Do you agree with recent polls showing that the party could perhaps even give the EFF a run for its money, or do you think it's a bit overstated?
Look, I am not keen to speak about the politics of the polling system in South Africa, but I do think the MK Party has been able to make a dent for itself. I mean, it was involved in several court cases and has sort of used them as some form of mini rallies that have gone viral, not only on social media, but on national TV as well. So this has really given the party enough heft to make more than a dent for itself in the voters' imagination, of course. Just a reaction on the markets as well. I think it is expected that there would be this kind of reaction. You'd remember that the MK Party was established, I think, in December 2023. So less than 6-7 months later, you know, we are seeing all these polls suggesting all sorts of things. So it was a bit of a shock for this particular poll at this present time in juncture to say, this is what you're predicting. So it was quite scary. And there's a lot of fears, I think, because, again, with the party having been established in December, there are no clear policies in place. So if you now come and say this is likely to be the third biggest party, then what are you telling us? That could mean a whole lot of different things for the country post the elections.
What I was thinking last week when the markets kind of had this jittery reaction, I think the market's response to the latest polls and, of course, also the judgments and what's happening in our courts around the MK party and Zuma is more an indication of just how much investors dislike uncertainty. And I feel that's a perfect reflection of really what we are experiencing as South Africans. We're also feeling an uncomfortable level of uncertainty about the future. But I was happy to read a report by the Institute for Security Studies on Daily Maverick saying that, quote, it is unlikely that the country will experience the level of widespread violence seen in July 2021, end quote. And I think that's a concern many voters might have. So it's reassuring to hear organizations like the ISS coming forward and saying, you know what, we don't anticipate things to go completely crazy and violent in the way that we've seen before. There's certainly a lot of uncertainty for us in the coming months.
Absolutely. And I guess the difference between us and the markets is that, you know, we don't show our concern in the most practical of ways, you know, beyond just protesting and all of that.
Now, Zuma's court victory is certainly not the only newsworthy one. The DA also had its own win when the IEC agreed to provide more voting stations for South Africans living abroad. The DA demanded more polling stations after several South Africans residing in Perth, specifically in Australia, were unable to cast their vote at an honorary consulate. Now, that basically, from my understanding, means that it's a consulate that's not under the direct management of a South African official. Granted, the majority of people abroad are likely DA voters, but I think it is a win for democracy in the long run.
No, certainly. There's certainly no doubt about that. I mean, voting is everybody's constitutional right, regardless of their political affiliation. So it certainly was a victory, not only for those South Africans that are abroad, but I think for democracy at large. And I think if you think about it, there's a number of them in different cities, and there were only 125 voting centers, which excluded thousands of people who are not or did not stay nearby these capital cities. So I think it was necessary.
And I must say, we've also been contacted by a few people, in this case, specifically in the US, who also voiced their concerns about the very few voting stations that were available to them. In fact, the few people that I've spoken who said that it's pretty much New York or Washington, D.C., and that's pretty much it. And we know the U.S. is massive. So to just have those two locations is quite impractical. So this will hopefully enable them to also make their mark in May.
Several areas flooded. Wind speeds of up to 135 kilometers per hour. Hundreds of homes destroyed and damage amounting to millions of rands. The recent storms in the Western Cape is a vivid reminder that we are at the mercy of increasingly extreme weather. On the upside, the coming winter months are looking a bit more promising for the country's farmers.
Moving from political storms, so to speak, to actual storms, and the Western Cape suffered severe storms last week, with several areas experiencing gale force winds of up to 135 kilometers an hour, which I just can't imagine. There was also flooding, infrastructure damage, many schools were closed, and I think a total of something around 140 schools reported structural damage. So it was really intense. And I feel like these storms are getting more intense every year. And the visuals we see coming from the Western Cape just get more horrendous.
Certainly, the visuals have been absolutely horrific. And I can't imagine what these people must be going through. I mean, to be quite honest, this inclement weather mostly affects the most vulnerable members in our communities. I think it's been great that there has been some level of support afforded to them. But then again, I think the impact goes beyond just, you know, their homes. I know, for example, there was an announcement that trains would not be running. And we know that, you know, trains are the most affordable form of transport. So you can imagine the suffering. I think it literally affects all parts of their lives because you now have to make, you know, alternative transport. You know, there's just a lot.
And of course, you know, as is always the case, and it always warms my heart to see it, but Gift of the Givers again showed up to assist affected communities across 17 areas by providing food and blankets, which is extremely important for these communities who really lose everything when inclement weather like this hits their regions. I know Daily Maverick accompanied Gifts of the Givers in Luandle and Nomzamo in Strand, where 1,500 people were helped. And of course, our listeners can go and read all about the amazing efforts from Gifts of the Givers on Daily Maverick's website. Now, the winter storms have also turned our attention towards what the critical winter period could hold for South African agriculture. One of my favorite agriculture experts and economists, Wandile Sisihlobo, recently wrote an excellent piece on Daily Maverick on what farmers should expect. And thankfully, he has a pretty optimistic outlook, saying the waning El Nino state should help farmers, especially in the Western Cape. According to his report or his analysis, we're in for a fairly normal winter month, which is very important for our citrus exporters, but also for people outside of the Western Cape. Just in terms of climate and agriculture and food security, obviously it's a going concern for a lot of people.
I'm concerned like everybody else. I mean, I'm a consumer, but I would think farmers are more concerned because obviously these extreme weather conditions do prevent crops from growing, especially when, you know, there are floods, droughts and all of that. So it does affect ultimately how much food we have. I think the quality as well, the quantity. So I am quite concerned. And I mean, for me personally, I can just put on a jacket or blankets and all of that. But I don't think farmers are in a position to implement measures to sort of guard against this. Even when there are measures, I think they're quite limited because no one is in control of these severe weather conditions.
Yes, and certainly as we see weather patterns becoming more extreme, I think it becomes more important for government to maybe reassess some of their policies and provide better contingencies to ensure that our farmers are able to deal with, let's say, severe drought or extreme levels of rain, and that our farmers and our food security is better protected and kind of cushioned from the various weather disasters. When two South African soldiers were killed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in February this year, it focused our attention on the abysmal state of our defense forces. Now, recent reports have shown just how broken the Department of Defense has become. But fixing it will cost billions. Billions we simply don't have. I want us to now get into defense news, and this one is of national importance. A recent report by Defense Web, as well as City Press and Rapport, showed just how broken the SANDF and the Department of Defense is. It's certainly no secret. I mean, we've done many stories on the military. Daily Maverick has covered it a lot. And we all know that the military certainly isn't what it used to be. But the various articles are very concerning. Just in terms of building maintenance, the department needs at least 8 billion rand just to upgrade some of the buildings, or not even upgrade, but just ensure that they're habitable for their staff. City Press further reported that more than 600 SA soldiers currently in the DRC have no field kitchens, no bathrooms or proper toilets. And then, of course, no doctors or nurses were deployed with the troops, which is just mind-boggling in itself. What is going on with our military? How did we end up here?
To be quite honest, it's been long coming. There has been reports, I think, that date back as far as a decade ago. I think they have really gone ignored, to be quite honest, or rather they've fallen on deaf ears. I think the opposition parties have done a great job in terms of just saying, hello, pay attention to this. And I don't think government has taken it as seriously as it should have. And this is why we found ourselves in this position. You spoke about the troops that are deployed at the DRC. I think that mission alone cost about 2.5 billion rands, which is a lot on its own. And I think it's just scary, the thought of having a defense force that can possibly not be able to avert, say, a national crisis.
Yeah, and you just touched on what I was about to comment on, that it just seems to be getting worse and worse. And as you've said, it's been reported on for close to a decade, people voicing their concerns and saying, listen, you need to start acting because we're going to end up in a position that we really should not be in. And I'm just wondering if government recognizes just how vulnerable this leaves us as a nation.
It's hard to tell, Lizanne, to be quite honest. But I am getting a sense that they do not recognize the threat and the position this has put us in. I mean, if that was the case, surely we would have seen, you know, an increase in the budget. I mean, you do know that political leaders have called upon the SNDF for a lot of things, assignments, you know, from international training, peacekeeping missions, domestic law and order service activities, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, just going back to the COVID time as well, the SNDF played a very crucial role during the 2021 riots. They were literally at the forefront. I can't imagine how that would have turned out had they not been there. So there's been multiple reports about the army not having enough troops to go every way, because also not only do they do domestic activities, but they also get called to do work internationally. So I am honestly not getting a sense that the issues there are being prioritized. Definitely not.
And things have also gotten so bad that former generals are now speaking out. And that's something that's really unheard of within the military circles. They tend not to speak out. It's a very close network. One former general told City Press, quote, the military is overburdened and underfunded, unquote, which is not a surprise. But I'm also wondering, you've just touched on the whole budgetary constraints and the issues around that. With money being tight within the national treasury, we know there's not a lot of money to go around in any case. The question then becomes, where do you cut to fund the military?
Certainly. I think one of the biggest and critical questions is, what do we give up? Because ultimately, I think we do need a new defense review. And I think this has just been the general sentiment. You know, we need to really examine the role of the defense in this country. We need perhaps to define when and at what point does the force intervene? What missions do we take up? What missions do we not take up? Obviously, taking into consideration the budgetary constraints. And I think we really ought to look at the top management, cutting back, because there's a lot of senior officials whose roles we can do away with. And I think it's unacceptable that taxpayers are expected to keep shelling out for this.
Every day, Sepelo Lose gets on his trusty bicycle to save lives. You see, between January and March of this year, roughly 25,300 parcels of life-saving HIV medication were never collected at various Eastern Cape clinics. This is largely due to long traveling times to get to the clinics, working hours, and a shortage of pickup points, especially in rural areas. But Sepelo is determined to be of service, one box of ARVs at a time. Then we reflect on endurance athlete Russell Cook's incredible journey as he becomes the first person to run the entire length of Africa.
Now, moving on to our green shoots, finally, we're getting into some good news. First up, we have a wonderful story published by Becky Sisa about a guy delivering much-needed ARVs within his community. And he's doing it on his bike, which I thought was just lovely. I loved this initiative. Didn't it just make you smile?
So when I read the story, I thought, oh my goodness, this is such an important piece of journalism. It is solution-driven kind of journalism. And I think for the longest time, you know, South Africa was the epicenter of the HIV pandemic in the world. And I think part of the problem has precisely been that people are struggling to access this treatment. So to have someone do this almost at no cost is just really mind-blowing. And I remember reading part of the story that says he gets like paid 7 rand per box for each, like, an every home delivery that he does. Last month, I know he got 161, having delivered 23 parcels. And he was quoted as saying, it's not about the money, it's about people. I thought he was so selfless, and I thought we could learn a thing or two from this gentleman.
I also read that and I thought, wow, what an amazing guy. But even before he started with this initiative, he made it very clear that this has always been his calling, because he says that before he started delivering meds, he used to take people's clinic cards from especially the farm workers who couldn't make it to the clinics in time because they start very early on the farms and they come home very late. He would take their clinic cards and go and collect their medication for them. I mean, this guy is doing phenomenal work. He is saving lives. And I think that is just wonderful. It is such a rare find in our country. And I think people like him should absolutely be celebrated. But then there's another guy, and he's a little bit more crazy. I always marvel at these individuals who do these extreme journeys for charity. And in this case, it's a guy called Russell Cook, aka he calls himself the hardest geezer, which I love. And this 27-year-old dude just ran his way through 16 African countries covering the length of Africa, and it took him about 352 days to complete. I mean, it's madness. It's pure madness. I don't understand these people. They are alien to me, but also absolutely remarkable.
You and I are literally on the same boat. Like, I never understand this. But I think when I read the reason behind why he was doing it, I think I was quite... my heart was just all melted, you know. I was just like, oh my goodness. And I think more than anything, as I kept on reading the article, I realized that, you know, he encounters a lot of major setbacks, including an armed robbery in one of the countries. And I thought to myself, if that was me, I would have literally stopped and, you know, did away with the entire mission. But he didn't. I think there was another incident where he had like a health scare. So there's just a couple of stumbling blocks, but he just soldiered on. So I thought that was very inspiring.
Look, if there was an armed robbery in this, I would have been like, that's it, I'm done. I'm taking off my running shoes. I'm going home. But I also found it interesting, you know, when he was asked what he craved the most throughout this crazy journey, do you know what he said? He actually said a strawberry daiquiri, which I thought was very random, but fair enough, whatever floats your boat. Now, I want to know from you, if you were to go on a 300-plus day journey like this, what would be the one thing that you would be craving the most? For me, it would be sushi. I love sushi. I can't live without it.
It's a tricky one because I'm generally a foodie, but I'd probably want my mother's lasagna. She makes the best in the world. I'd probably want lots of ice cream, and I definitely want to be streaming something, you know?
Absolutely. I think we're on the same page. It'll be definitely food related for me as well. Maybe books. I will definitely miss hard copy books because I love reading. But yeah, definitely food will be top of my list. But this has been a lovely chat. Thank you so much for making the time to chat to us. Love hearing your thoughts, and we look forward to having you back on the show again very soon.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to coming back as well. Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap. Join us again next week as we unpack more local and international headlines. Until then, give Carte Blanche and Daily Maverick a like and follow on socials.